I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Join us as we explore health, community, and culture from a holistic perspective. Health topics addressed on our show are for information and entertainment and should not be taken as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us tonight. I'm Kevin Middleton, and tonight our guest is Dan Bigley, author of Beyond the Bear, How I Learned to Live and Love Again After Being Blinded by a Bear. Beyond the Bear is the riveting and uplifting story of Dan's experience being mauled by an Alaskan brown bear in July of 2003. It was one of the worst maulings in recent Alaskan history. At 25 years of age, he suffered nearly fatal injuries that have been described as nearly the worst a body can suffer and still be alive. The trauma to his head was so severe he was left blind and disfigured with just a thread of a chance to survive. His book tells the graphic story of that day and the extraordinary recovery and transformational journey that followed. As a part of his healing journey, Dan has developed a powerful inspirational presentation that reveals how love, community support, and a positive attitude have helped him find meaning, success, and happiness in life. He shares a story of learning to move beyond the bear to embrace a new future with a variety of audiences, both in and out of Alaska. And that includes civic leaders, business communities, corporate retreats, sports teams, health and social service providers, school kids, and troubled teens. His presentation topics include overcoming adversity, maximizing resiliency, the use of guide dogs, living with trauma, and the power of positive thinking. His commitment to giving back caught the attention of the Governor's Committee on Employment and Rehabilitation of People with Disabilities, which presented him with the Alaskan of the Year Award in 2008. Dan, welcome to the show. We're really glad to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
You bet.
Pleasure.
You bet. You know, before we get started, I'm wondering if I can just read a passage from your book that talks
Absolutely.
A little bit about the extent of your injuries.
Yeah.
Upper nose, eyes, forehead, anatomy unrecognizable is how the medevac report had put it. Covered in dried blood with shreds of skin and forest debris all mashed together, the top half of Bigley's head was skewed to the left. His scalp was split open at the forehead, and on the left side a flap of skin was peeled back, exposing a jumble of tissue, shards, and bone. Dr. Coleman knew from the CT scan that the dura mater, a membrane protecting the brain, was probably torn. He could see exposed brain tissue from behind the ruins of the nose. Then there were the eyes. At first, Dr. McHugh had been unable to find them amid the blood and grime. The force of the bear's jaws had popped them from their sockets, snapping the optic nerves, leaving one hanging by a thread and the other by just a few threads more. Both were intact, but were on the same side of Bigley's shattered nose. It was obvious. One was hopeless. The other had just enough connective tissue possibly to survive. Although with the optic nerve severed, it would never see. If Bigley lived, there was no doubt at all that he would be blind. Of all his injuries, his shattered anterior skull base was the one most likely to kill him. With nothing to hold it up, the bottom of his brain had herniated down into his nose, exposing it to the world. And then later, in the morning, with an operating room team mobilized, an anesthesiologist in place, everything was ready to go. Dressed in blue scrubs, hands scoured and snapped into latex gloves, Dr. Coleman walked into the operating room and up to the stainless steel table where Bigley lay on his back, prepped and draped with his ravaged body covered by a warming blanket. He stared down at the chaos before him and froze. There was no manual for this one. Bear maulings were hardly on any East Coast medical school's checklist of commonly encountered traumas for residents to master. Where to begin? Dr. Coleman figured he must look pretty lost because one of the senior operating room nurses walked up and put a hand on his shoulder and asked, "Doctor, would you like to shave the hair?" Coleman turned to her. Right, that's where we'll start. We'll start with shaving the hair. Wow. So that's hard to even conceive of, Dan.
Yeah.
So maybe you can walk us through that day and describe what happened.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so it was middle of, July 14th, 2003, and one of those beautiful, beautiful sunny Alaska days that, you know, is a big reason why we all live here and can tolerate the weather and the long winters. You know, I had said goodbye earlier that day to a woman, Amber, who I'd had interest in for a while, but just that night before had really, you know, had a night together that it was clear that we were moving into relationship stage, you know, where we were going to be kind of dating. And so thought about asking her to come fishing with me, and she thought about asking me, but we both, you know, having had just kind of made that connection the night before, decided it was best to take it slow type of thing. So we said our goodbyes, and I was off with my good friend John and my dog Maya to go down to the Russian and Kenai Rivers and do some fishing. And it was, you know, just like I said, just an epically beautiful day. And we, you know, caught some fish and just enjoyed being outdoors in the Alaska summer. And it was pretty late in the evening, but, you know, in Alaska where it's light pretty much 24 hours a day during that time of the year, light was of no short supply. So we started heading back up the river towards the trailhead, having caught the fish for the day and knowing that we needed to get back to work the following day. So anyway, we were pretty close to the trailhead when all of a sudden my dog Maya lets out a little growl. And it was just enough of a growl that caused me to, you know, stop and just look up to see what she was seeing. And about 30, 40 feet away, in front of us on the trail, but kind of off to the side, just the way the trail curved a little, was a large, menacing grizzly bear. And we didn't know at the time, but, you know, she ended up being a sow. And, you know, having bear encounters here in Alaska, especially as an angler, is not that uncommon. And as somebody who spent a lot of time wandering backcountry with a backpack on, I had probably had close to 20 bear encounters prior, and this one was very, very different. I've seen all kinds of things and seen bears do all kinds of things, but this one was by far the most menacing. You know, typically they're running away or not noticing you, but this one turned immediately to face us, her hair on her back, you know, on her haunches raised on end, and immediately starts huffing and puffing and stomping her feet. So my friend John and I, you know, both pretty experienced in the outdoors, we huddled close and raised our hands to make ourselves look big, and stood together and, you know, tried to make a decision about, well, first we just paused, and you know, typically that's enough to cause them to go in the other direction. Then when we realized she wasn't budging, we talked about what, you know, what our best move was and decided to back away slowly and head upriver and, you know, just totally avoid her altogether and take a longer way back around to the trailhead. So that's what we did. And we had done that successfully. We started heading up the river and, you know, out of sight of the bear and had just got to a point to where we thought, okay, whew, that was crazy, you know, that was pretty close. You know, she was behaving kind of crazy and wonder what that was all about, you know, type of a conversation. When all of a sudden in front of us on the trail, the alder trees started shaking pretty vigorously. And at that moment, you know, it was clear there was a large animal in the bushes and the alders. And so we couldn't see anything. But, you know, at that moment, our stomachs both sank and our hearts, you know, went into overdrive what we assumed was happening was that the bear had sort of cut us off in a sort of stalking behavior, which would be highly abnormal and certainly nothing that I had experienced and nor anything that I'd ever hoped to experience.
Were you carrying fish at that time?
Yeah, we were. We definitely were. Yeah. Though, you know, in summertime in Alaska, sometimes the rivers and streams can be filled with fish. So we definitely felt that having the fish was an additional risk factor, but at the same time, you know, perhaps not as as it may seem initially to others around the world, just to, you know, sometimes along these riverbanks in Alaska, particularly along the Russian River, it's a smorgasbord, almost a buffet line for bears, you know, with carcasses laying all around and, you know, fish filling the rivers. But yeah, we were carrying fish. And so we turned around immediately when the bushes started shaking, and we started heading back towards the trailhead in the direction we had just come. And we'd taken no more than probably, you know, 10, 15 steps when, you know, I guess the way I put it is the completely unimaginable happened, and that is that the grizzly sow came tearing around the corner in front of us at missile speed, so fast that she had to dip her front left shoulder just to make the turn, and was on us in just seconds or moments. My dog, Maya, who was in the front of our group, you know, just John and Maya and myself, was the first, was in the front of the line, and so she went leaping off the trail to the left, and the bear took a swipe at her, but didn't change directions, didn't hit her, you know, but she kept running on down the trail. And so John, you know, who was the next target in front of me, and so between the bear and I, John went leaping off the trail into some alders on the right, and you know, quite literally, you know, we were in our waders still and wading boots and whatnot, and quite literally he jumped higher than I've ever seen anybody jump ever, and left both of his wading boots on the trail. I mean, literally leaped right out of his shoes. And unfortunately, well, you know, for better or worse, I suppose, the bear did not change direction. And so at this point, there was nothing between the bear and I, and nothing between the bear and the shaking bushes behind us but me. And so I tried to leap off the trail, made a huge jump into some bushes off to my left, and as I hit the ground, you know, as I was planning on hitting the ground, you know, sort of interlocked my hands behind my bed and behind my head, and was planning on laying face down, hands locked behind my neck. And before I had even fully hit the ground, the bear had a hold of my leg and was pulling me out of the bushes, kind of in the way that, you know, dogs sometimes pull on a sock with both paws when you're playing tug of war. She was sort of, you know, yanking on my leg with both claws, kind of grabbing it. And so I could immediately feel, you know, claws puncturing the leg and tearing into the muscle on my quad. And it's at that moment when I heard a sound that was a pathetic and miserable sound, one that you would expect to hear from sort of a dying animal, and it took me a second to then realize that was me that was making that sound. And the next thing I knew, she had grabbed a hold of me by what we think must have been my head, and was tearing off down the trail and then running into the woods. And so all I felt was the ground moving by underneath me as she dragged me off into the woods, roots and rocks and, you know, grass and debris.
By your head.
Yeah, yeah. And then when she got me into the woods a ways, you know, she stopped. And I lost consciousness there for a while. I'm not sure if it was from, you know, her biting on down on the head, or if it was hitting a rock or a root or something, but there was some sort of impact that caused me to lose consciousness at that point. And what proceeded then over the next several minutes, as best as I can tell, in terms of the length of time, obviously measuring time in that sort of state is hard to do, but it was basically coming in and out of consciousness. And so the first time I came back to consciousness, I could feel her still standing on me, still over me. And then I would lose consciousness again. And the next time I came to, I could feel her weight bearing down on both shoulders and hear the massive, as she grunted and huffed and breathed, I could hear just this massive volume of her lungs and just massive power of the animal as, you know, she was mauling me. And then I felt, you know, her breath on my face. And that's when I knew that it wasn't, you know, obviously I wasn't in a good place since the beginning, but this, I was like, holy cow, you know, how did I get flipped over? Now I'm face up. And she was standing over me with both arms sort of, or both of her claws digging into my shoulders. So then I lost consciousness again. And as I came to the next time, I heard of my buddy John that I was with calling my name from a distance. And I knew I had been drugged by the bear, but I didn't know how far. And so I wanted him to know where I was for any potential rescue that might be coming. And so I, you know, in hindsight, perhaps made the mistake of calling back to him. And whatever it was, I guess, too much sign of life for the sow to be happy, because when I yelled in return, she returned to me, unfortunately. And that's when the sort of death blow came, where she cocked her head sideways across my face and bit down, you know, basically closing her jaws around my face. And obviously, at that point, I don't know how to say it. I, you know, was dismissed. I woke up. Next thing I knew, I was in a place of a blue light, is what I call it. I was no longer, you know, in a physical world. It was nothing but this brilliant, sort of radiant, almost like a Smurf blue light all around, with no shape or form or anything. And the first thing I did as I kind of came to there was, you know, kind of just try to figure out, am I okay? Where am I? What's going on? And there was no pain. There was no horror or terror in this place. It was a very peaceful and surreal place to be.
Were you aware of what was happening to you on a physical level at that point?
Hard to say. I mean, I don't remember thinking, but I do think that there was a sense of knowing, yeah. I mean, that where I had just been, and now I was here, yeah. The questions in my mind were more about, where was I? And what was this all about?
Was it a lucid experience?
Very much so. Very much so. Yeah, I mean, it was as if I was there and able to consciously reflect on being there and had power of choice and will in that place. And the first thing that then dawned on me was that I was at a crossroads, you know, that I was at a place where the easiest thing to do would just be to let go and to die, you know? And I was very aware that that would be a really easy thing to do, and then that would be it. Then it would be done, and easy, you know, was the way it felt. And I knew that I had another choice, which was to fight to live. And I knew that there was no telling, you know, how that could turn out, if I would be successful or if I did survive, you know, what kind of shape I would be in or what life would be left for me. And almost as soon as I realized I was at this crossroads, this place where I had some degree of choice is what it felt like, then all of a sudden for reasons bigger than myself, unknown to myself, you know, all of a sudden this image, almost like a home video image, like in real picture, I saw a vivid image of my mom, sort of from, you know, the midsection up, you know, shoulder, like a headshot of my mom, and she was smiling, just as happy as I've ever seen her, glowing, I would say, you know, like with happiness and love and radiance, and she was waving to me.
Is she currently alive?
She is, yeah, she is. And interestingly, you know, my mom and I, you know, I love her to death, and she's always been a wonderful soul and person in my life, but we have had a troubled relationship at times, you know. But I reflect on this as, you know, this, what, for whatever reason, again, probably bigger than myself, you know, this primordial connection and this primordial love that exists between mother and child, is why this image presented itself to me at that moment. And in feeling that was evoked with this image of my mom and her happiness and her waving to me, I knew that I was going to fight to live. And then forecasting ahead in my mind and thinking ahead and knowing that this was going to be a tough go, I made a deal with myself. It was a sort of contract with myself, that I would never allow myself to look back and question that decision to live, that I would never, no matter how bad things got, regret my decision, or even question it. And so that's where the sort of turning point was, really. It was, as soon as I had made that decision, what happened next was interesting. I basically looked over in this place of this blue. So my mom, the image of my mom was gone, and I'm back in this place where there's nothing but this blue light. And I see, not in body shape, not in physical presence, but I see a sort of a silhouette, a translucent, transparent silhouette of a tall, lanky feller standing at a distance, kind of nodding with approval, who is unmistakably my grandfather, who is no longer with us and was no longer with us at the time. And he's also a great fisherman, and kind of, you know, I grew up learning to fish with him and often thought of him out on the river, and always wanted, even though I knew that he wasn't around to approve, I always wanted to be somebody that he would approve of, you know, sort of an influence in my life. And as soon as I, you know, kind of acknowledged his presence, it became clear to me as I looked around further that there was many people there in this shapeless lack of physical presence, but very much an energetic spiritual presence. And there were people, all kinds of people, who basically, it seemed like anybody who had ever really loved and cared for me on some level was present. And they decided that I needed to go back, but that I didn't need to go back right away, and that I could stay and rest for a while there. And so I did. And at some point, it was decided I was to return to the Russian. And so almost like going through a well back into the physical plane, I sort of did. And the next thing I knew, I was waking up back at the Russian. And as I came back to consciousness there, what I remember vividly is the sound of a quiet forest, and knowing that, in hearing the birds singing and the wind rustling in the trees, and in hearing the river passing by at a small distance, that the bear had gone, and I was now alone in the forest. And I obviously remember feeling a great sense of relief with that. And so quickly started thinking about what I needed to do to survive, and took stock of my condition and realized I was in no condition to try to crawl out or to move.
Could you move at that point at all?
I don't know if I physically could, but I remember trying and very quickly just realizing that the only thing for me to do was to try to save every ounce of energy that I had to live. The feeling was that any exertion that I do physically could drain the rest of the life in me out, you know? So the only choice I had was just to try to be as calm and as still as possible and save every ounce of energy I had for what was ahead. And I could feel at that point, you know, blood running down my face and pooling up under my head and on the forest floor, and I could feel my waders filling with blood from the injuries sustained on my body and on my legs.
Was John with you at that time? Did he come back?
He wasn't, no. Nope. And so it was a huge relief. I mean, I guess kind of in filling in some of the blanks afterwards and in many hours of interviews with other people, I guess what happened was, you know, John ran to get himself to a safe distance, as, you know, he didn't have a gun or anything and certainly didn't want to get both of us mauled. And so he went basically looking for help and started calling for help. And my dog, Maya, you know, she had come running back at some point, you know, after hearing me yell and sort of getting tore into a little bit. And John cut her off and, you know, kind of gave her a swift kick to the chest and yelled at her to get out of there. And she then took off down trail back towards the river where we'd been fishing. And I guess I'd come across some hikers and, or not hikers, but some fishermen that were coming back up the trail. And they recognized her from our group earlier in the day. And Maya, my dog, was, you know, barking, and her hackles were raised on end and kind of running back and forth on the trail in front of them. And they knew right then. They said, this is, something's not right. You know, something's definitely not right here. And so they, you know, with Maya, went back up the trail and found where John was. And then all of Maya was able to kind of lead them to where I was, cached in the woods. When John saw me, obviously he dropped immediately to my side. And I remember, you know, the feeling of comfort knowing that he was there. One of the other fishermen immediately took off their shirt and got it wrapped around my head, and they went for help, leaving John, because they didn't have a cell phone or a gun either.
Dan, we're going to take a brief break here, just a moment, and we'll be back. You're listening to Radio Free Palmer, and we're speaking with Dan Bigley, author of Beyond the Bear, How I Learned to Live and Love Again After Being Blinded by a Bear. Stay with us, and we'll be right back.
Community radio is what you make it. If you want to be involved with Radio Free Palmer, contact us on the web, radiofreepalmer.org. We're looking for ideas, we're looking for volunteers, and we're looking for help. Thank you so much, and enjoy. Thank you.
Welcome back to The Bridge to Everywhere. We're speaking with Dan Bigley, author of Beyond the Bear, a new book that's out. If you're here in Palmer, you can get it at Fireside Books. They have it in stock. That's where I got my copy, autographed copy. If you're out of state, you can find it on Amazon.com. 5-star ratings all across the board. If you go there, you can just see the incredible reviews that are coming in. So, Dan, I wanted to ask you a question. You had spoken about the powerful experience that happened when your consciousness shift, when you were left for dead by the bear. And I'm wondering if you would have considered yourself to be a deeply spiritual person before that happened, and if that changed anything for you in that way. And then maybe after that, talk a little bit about the rescue.
Yeah, you know, I think, I mean, I definitely have always considered myself to be a spiritual person, and you know, often in my young years, sought to find that connection and feel that connection through experiences in nature, and mostly experiences in wild places, you know, kind of connecting to that more animal side of the human experience, and but also obviously in connection with people. And so as far as how I would describe how this experience affected my spiritual philosophy or spiritual connection, you know, that experience obviously altered both my philosophy and my, I guess, for lack of better words, personal clarity on the subject, for as far as really solidifying my belief that we're never alone. You know, we always are connected on some alternate realm. And, you know, to not take that for granted, but to be aware of that and appreciate that, and to really do our part. And as people were there for me through this connection, that I always, you know, obviously try to live a life of being the best friend I can to my friend and being the best person I can for our community and for humanity, knowing that we are all connected in that way. And, you know, something that happened in the aftermath really embedded this a lot further. So just to speak to for a second about some of what was going on medically at this time as I woke up in the forest, you know, so slowly and surely more people did come there to the scene where I was laying on the forest floor, and it would be 2 hours before the EMTs would arrive and nearly 4 hours before the helicopter would arrive. So almost 4.5 hours before I would arrive at a hospital, at definitive medical care. And so in the 2 hours waiting for the EMTs to arrive, you can imagine, I mean, the experience that was had there. But it was reported to me by people on the scene that there were times where I would stop breathing, and they would go to initiate CPR, and, you know, moments before they would start compressions, I would sort of gasp for air, so I was really in a tenuous place as this was reported to happen, you know, several times during that couple-hour span. I was really hanging on by a thread. And I'm not sure exactly when all of this occurred in terms of what I was then experiencing in my state, because my state of consciousness tended to ebb and flow in and out of reality, for the better part of the next 2 weeks, actually, and mostly out of reality for that time frame, especially after I was put in a medically induced coma.
And during that time, was it a blank for you, or was there actual?
No. Okay. I was living in this very vivid, very chaotic at times, very scary at times, very surreal and serene and spirit-filled at times, sort of dream state, if you will, very alternate. It was like imagine being in a lucid dream that you were in for 2 weeks, and that's really where I was living during that time. And so I had this experience, though, going back to the spirit question, that forever impacted me, and it was clearly probably, you know, somehow coming out of the archetypal framework of my psyche, if you will. But where I had been brought to this medical facility that was in near my hometown, near Monterey, California, and I was as the helicopter landed there, and this is all in my dream state, mind you, not in reality. As the helicopter landed there, you know, I was looking out across the ocean that I grew up near, the cypress trees that I grew up near, just that beauty of the coast there, and taken into this facility. And at first, there was some chaos that happened, and, you know, I won't go get too lost in the tangents. But then the next thing I knew, I was left alone in this room that was circular and with beautiful bay windows looking out onto the scene that I described of the bay, Monterey Bay, and the cypress trees and whatnot. And there was a sunken floor that sort of had tiers, like as if it was like an auditorium of sorts, you know. But it was small, you know, maybe no more than 30 feet across, and went down to a central area. And I was left there with blankets, and the next thing I know, first I look back in the back of the room, and there's a large stuffed grizzly bear standing there. And it kind of freaked me out, obviously, and I was like, whoa, you know. And then I look, and there's this glass case, and inside the glass case there's like sort of a panorama of the scene at the Russian River. And the trails, and I thought, wow, this is interesting. I wonder if this is how they are, you know, how they're best understanding what happened to me or something, you know. And then the next thing I know, a door opens, and in file, in single file, and in silence, I would say maybe 20 or so Buddhist monks in full robe and garb and with prayer beads dangling around their hands. And they come in total silence and fill in this space and sit in circles, layered, so sort of going down and up the different tiers. And they sit in silence and just sort of meditate. And I take in this peacefulness. It gets internalized into my body through their calm. And I remember, you know, eye contact vividly with different members and, you know, different looks that I would get from them of, you know, both power but also of approval and you know, almost like they were giving me nods of, you know, you're okay, you're going to be okay. And so this great sense of peacefulness was sort of internalized. And, you know, the story goes on from there, and this, you know, crazy nurse comes in and gives me medication that I didn't want, and it kind of, you know, went on from there. But that there were moments like that throughout that really helped me find my center, helped me feel grounded and connected, and it really was those moments, I think, that gave me strength, that gave me the focus I needed to be carried through. And so certainly those experiences, as well as my experience in that place of the blue light I described, have forever altered my sense of spirit and connection to that. And
does that quality of peace that you experienced persist even now? Is that current?
Absolutely, 100%. And when I have trauma symptoms now or in past, when I have feelings of anxiety or panic or concerns about, you know, safety of myself or my kids or whatever, or concerns about bears out in wild places, I consciously shift my thoughts to those memories and to that place of like where I was emotionally and spiritually when the monks were there, and I remember, you know, the faces of my children when they're smiling and saying, I love you, Dad, or you know, getting a hug from my wife, and it brings me back to that place of gratitude. And, you know, when I first came back to consciousness in the hospital, and maybe even slightly before as well, but when my entire body was in incredible amounts of physical agony and emotionally, I was just in, you know, like I couldn't even go there yet. I mean, my emotions were still behind an ironclad wall in the fortress of unsafe, because I was still fighting to live every day in survival mode, you know.
Were you aware that you had lost your vision?
Not immediately, no. And I'll get to that in a moment. But what I would do when that was happening, when I was in, you know, just tons of physical and emotional pain and stress, there was this one place in my body, and it was right around the place, you know, where our rib cage meets our stomach, like our solar plex, you know, and I had a feeling there, and it was a good feeling. It was a spirit feeling, and it was like this, the feeling of being alive, you know, that was so vivid and real, considering how close I was to not having that feeling anymore, and I was so aware of it, and it was a good feeling. It was a euphoric feeling, and I would just focus all my energy and attention on that one place in my body, and kind of when I would go there, it was like a dissociation of sorts, I guess, to put a medical label on it. But for me, it would bring me to a place of gratitude. It would bring me to a place of being grateful to have that feeling, being grateful to be alive.
And then what happened in the next step of your recovery?
Well, you know, then came, as I alluded to just a minute ago, then came the news from doctors that I was going to be blind for the rest of my life. And I couldn't talk at the time. I had come out of a coma. I could barely lift my head or lift my arm. And so I really didn't know I was blind. I thought I just had bandages wrapped around my head, to be honest. And I'll never forget when they told me I was going to be blind. And I was kind of still back and forth between reality and the physical plane and that crazy dream place I referred to. And, man, the dreams got really crazy after that. I remember lots of dreams wherein I would argue with the doctors about being able to see, and I remember dreams about, you know, trying to escape from the hospital and drive off, knowing that they were wrong, you know. And so there was a lot of just kind of trying to accept and process my new reality. And the reality of it is I had no, I like to say I was the first blind person I ever met. so I really had no way of knowing what life for a blind person could be like. I still didn't know if I was going to live or not, but if I did live, I had no way of understanding, you know, and I was afraid of being, you know, alone for my whole life. Like, I didn't think I was quite going to be an eligible bachelor at that point. Obviously, it's hard to understand or comprehend how I could be emotionally or physically desirable to be a life partner. I didn't know if I was going to be able to live outside of an institution, to be honest, because I just really didn't know what life was like for blind people. And so I had sort of, you know, fears about, you know, what that was going to be like. And, you know, this is where the story takes a turn, and where the concept of hope is introduced, which was a really important turning point for us, my family and I mean, and, because that was really our darkest hour at that time in the recovery, and when a man from Juneau, who had spent a long time since 1959 as the only person that he knew of to be completely blinded by a bear and lived to tell about it, and his name's Lee Hagmeyer, and he was blinded at 17 in a grizzly bear mauling down in Juneau, and he came to our hospital room there in Anchorage. And before I could talk, before I could interact, but, you know, he told me, you know, Dan, there's a lot to live for still. And he told me about his travels around the world and about sea kayaking and about backpacking and about fishing, about going back to school and getting advanced degrees after blindness. And it was amazing for me to be hearing this from where I was at. And he gave us, you know, the most valuable resource that we could ask for in that time, which was the resource of hope, you know, that there would be life, that I could do the things that I love to do. And that's where the story of how, with the power of love and with the power of a community of friends and family and a broader community that we live in, how I've been able to not just survive, not just to live, but to live completely, fully, and to really thrive in, you know, what some might consider the most unlikely of circumstances.
Do you feel that your worldview and your sense of joy in life is greater than it was before this incident happened?
Well, I mean, I have to say, yeah, I do. I mean, for one, I don't take anything for granted. I don't take a single day for granted. I don't take a single friendship for granted. I don't even take, you know, the broader community supports that supported me, you know, the social welfare safety nets, if you will, you know, of the Vision of Oak Rehab, of Alaska, you know, Center for the Blind, and all these different programs that supported me along the way. But, you know, I think most importantly, those human connections, you know. I mean, the community's response was amazing. I had people, a person from Talkeetna that literally called the hospital to let them know he would donate an eye if it would help me see again. I had people, you know, bringing my family moose stew because they just wanted to help somehow and they didn't know how else to help. I mean, it was just overwhelming and beautiful. And it reminds me of, you know, Helen Keller, the words Helen Keller said over 80 years ago now, when she talked about a community that didn't have the capacity to lift a person from blindness and take them back to living. She said, I dream of a day when a blind person would be taken by the hand and guided back to living fully. And I'm so happy and grateful to report that we now live in that world, and I have lived that life of being taken by the hand by many and shown the way back to living a very complete and full life. And the more I engage in all these things that, you know, I've been shown how to do again, you know, by all the people who have helped me engage from everybody, the more I engage, the sort of the bigger my life gets, you know. And it doesn't matter if I'm talking about engaging and, you know, play with my kids and cuddling and reading them books, or, you know, pursuing my passion for music, or getting back out and fishing, or pursuing my professional goals and dreams. That the more I engage, the bigger my life gets. And what I've found is that the bigger my life gets, the smaller my disability gets. And that's been my healing journey. That's been my path over the last 9, almost 10 years since the bear. This is how I've moved beyond the bear. I used to say, you know, that the bear gave me a new way to see as I learned how to see as a blind person. But now I realize that that's actually not true, that actually it was this broader community of support of friends and families and organizations and the communities that took me by the hand and showed me back to living. It's the people, it's humanity that's really given me a new way to see.
I want to ask you a question about this. And do you think that do we need a crisis? Do we need to have a crisis or a tragedy to make this kind of transformation?
Wow, that's a good question. I hope not. You know, I hope not. You know, it's interesting because I think there's some evolutionary grounds and merits to focusing on threats, to focusing on danger, to focus on what's not going well, and so to focus on the negative for that. In that, you know, as an animal species, when we focus on danger and threats and things that aren't good, it helps us survive. And so, evolutionary speaking, it makes sense. But in modern world, you know, we spend so much time, like, listen to the news every night. Listen to a 10-minute news cycle. You know, we have North Korea and threats of nuclear war. We have, you know, the economy and Afghanistan. And, you know, it's tragedy after tragedy after tragedy, and we're just fixated on that. And so what this story is for me, and what I hope that sharing the story can do for people is, it's an excellent example, and it gives us an opportunity, I think, to step out of that 10-minute news cycle and to reflect on a bigger picture here and to reflect on humanity in a different way and to say, you know what, this is beautiful. This is a beautiful thing that's happened here, and what an inspiring thing. And, you know, we are not that bad, and this world isn't that bad. And I think, you know, if we spend less time focusing on what we don't want to happen and more time focusing on the things in life that we do want to happen, then I think we're halfway there. And so, you know, I certainly don't pretend to think that this story will change the world, but that I want to do my little part, my little piece to say, hey, guys, let's focus on how beautiful we are and how wonderful this life and this world are, because if we focus on that, you know, that is the transformation. That's the work of the transformation, I think, to a much better time, to a much better era for humanity.
Really beautifully said. You know, like you say, listening to the news cycle, and you might start to, you know, feel like we're really, you know, things are terrible and, you know, humanity has really lost its way. And that's just one perspective. And sure, there are many, many problems, but we are in a, I mean, Steven Pinkett recently wrote a book called The Better Angels of Our Nature, where he outlines in great detail with statistical accuracy that in many, many ways we are doing better than ever before. And contrary to what most people would think, there's actually less violence.
Right.
And so this kind of perspective, this shift, you know, where, I mean, the kind of community support you received, the love, the deep care, that's been my experience, and that's been the experience of most everyone I know living in this culture where we have so much privilege and support and opportunity. And so our direct experience even counters what we're shown on TV.
Right,
And so I think it's just a really powerful message that we take a stand for how good things actually are.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, you know, and it's interesting. I mean, even to tangent a little bit, you know, even looking at, you know, Darwin, for example, you know, when people think of Darwin, they think survival of the fittest, and they talk about, you know, this fierce competition and, you know, but if you look in nature, there's equal, if not many more, examples of beautiful symbiosis and how things actually work together to create this really magnificent ecosystem full of relationships that support one another. And honestly, that's my preferred worldview, you know?
Absolutely. You know, and on that thread, I would love to have you circle back to Amber and just speak about that relationship too. And then we only have just a few more minutes after that. So
okay. Yeah. Well, again, the power of love to help us and to heal us. You know, so as I left Amber that morning before going fishing, I told her that I would call her when I got back. And, of course, that's the call that never came. And after I came out of a coma and, you know, she came the first time I was conscious and she came to the hospital room, I couldn't talk still. And I was writing on this whiteboard to communicate with the world. And I wrote the words, I'm blind. And she said, I know. And she sat down by my... I was sitting on a chair, and she sat on the floor and put her arms up on my knee, and I said, it's crazy. And she was like, yeah, I know, it's really crazy. And I wrote the words in. I said, I'm scared. And there was nothing to say, you know, to that. But we kept in touch, you know. Obviously, we couldn't be a couple, but we kept in touch, and I had to leave the state for some medical care as they weren't able to close up all the wounds on my head even after 4 surgical attempts here. So I needed some more specialized surgeries only available out of state, so I left. And we kept in touch, and, you know, it was neat that we built this relationship on the phone, because blindness was not a factor in our relationship that we built on the phone, right? It's just two voices, two minds. And what a beautiful thing the human mind and our spirits are. And so we built this relationship that where blindness wasn't even a factor for the better part of a year and a half while I was in California. And I returned to Alaska a year later to sort of do what I call my victory lap in hindsight, you know. At the time, it was more like getting back on the horse. I was doing something I knew I needed to do, and I went out on the river to go fishing again. But before I did that, the first thing that happened is Amber picked me up at the airport, and we went back to her house, and we had a beautiful night that once again, as it had a year and a half earlier, transformed our relationship from one of friendship to one of we were in a relationship. And I woke up that next morning and I said to her, "Hey, I'm going fishing and I'll call you when I get back." And happy to report that I did call her that day after fishing, and I was able to report that I caught a 40-pound king. And that was the beginning of our life together, which had now, you know, we have a 3- and 5-year-old child, and she's an amazing woman, you know. Behind the old adage that behind every man is an even every great man is an even greater woman is certainly true in this relationship, and she brings to the table sort of Midwestern stoicism. She's really the rock of this family that I have used for grounding, and all the time, and am eternally grateful to her spirit for our connection in our life that we share together, and also likewise then the kids, you know, have a part in my healing journey as well.
Absolutely. So what kind of work are you doing now, and maybe share with our audience a little bit about your book and how they can stay in touch with you?
Absolutely. So I'm a director of therapeutic foster care right now at Denali Family Services here in Anchorage. I'm also a therapist. I do some work with kids and families to keep families and people healthy and together and in the community, engaging in life, if you will, and helping people who have been through lots of different types of traumas and experienced lots of different diverse life experiences that are less than fortunate. And so always looking forward to continuing my growth in that area and my work, and definitely doing a lot of public speaking and getting out and sharing, you know, this message about humanity and about our ability to thrive in unlikely circumstances as human beings, and how we do that with a community of support. I'd love to keep in touch with folks, and best way to do that is probably through the website, danbigley.com or beyondthebear.com. There's a blog there. There's a way to sign up there for a mailing list for future things. You know, one of the projects I'm working on now is actually a CD with my band, Cedar Roots, so hopefully get that out soon. You know, who knows about future books? That's certainly, I'd say, a possibility. Lots of events coming up and exciting things. We just got a review in People magazine, for example, that, you know, we share all these happy developments. I'd love to keep people in touch as hopefully we work our way towards a motion picture.
So in the last 20 seconds here, so you've got a film that's coming up, and you also have a Facebook page, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely, and that can all be linked to through danbigley.com. Or beyondthebear.com.
Great.
To the Facebook pages.
Dan Bigley, thank you so much for joining us tonight on The Bridge to Everywhere. Dan's book, Beyond the Bear, is available now. It's available on Amazon.com or locally here in Palmer at Fireside Books. Thank you so much, Dan.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us on The Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links, and resources from our guests and show topics.